Blog Talk Radio.
Some say amazing, and I think that's probably a good way to describe it. A very good adjective that you could use. Some say other things, but I just find the simple word itself speaks volumes to me, and I'm speaking of grace. Where would I be without God's grace? Always thankful for it, always appreciative, and it just makes me feel so amazing. I'm Mark Elliott, your host of When Black Men Talk. And if you don't know by now, yeah, you know. Should I tell you? Yeah, I'll tell you, just in case you don't know. Black Men Talk is our weekly get-together between three gentlemen, myself, soon to be Mr. Demon Reese and Mr. Charles, where we get together and discuss a dialogue, provocative talk, as we explore the male's perspective on love, relationships, and life. Always shooting for honest self-valuation, and that's not always easy, but we basically hit the bullseye out of this the majority of times that I'm very proud of. And I love the fact that we don't shy away from things that need to be said. I'm going to bring in Mr. DeMaurice currently right now, and I'm going to put the question to you, Mr. DeMaurice. When you hear the word grace, take the amazing off and just grace on his own. What comes to mind, sir?
Hey, it's something that we all get, and I think we all, not all of us, but I think we take for granted that we're living under grace. And I'm appreciative of it because Lord knows I need it. Lord knows I need it. And sometimes you're going through your day and you're asking for it. You know, you're asking for grace and you're asking for blessing and guidance, but more so grace that, you know, you fall short a lot of the time. But you still get that grace, and I know I'm appreciative of it.
I like how you said you fall short, and we all do from time to time. But that's a beautiful thing, man. Even when you do, it's still more than enough there to supply you, and it's more is given to you. Mr. Charles, we're speaking of the word grace, and we say that. What comes to mind, sir?
Grace is, for me, I think it's, I think of forgiveness for my damn mistake. When you think about the grace of God, I go. And I laugh about that a little bit because I think about, I think when you know yourself, you know who you are, where you come from, where you originate from, and the person that you've developed into and become, we still make mistakes. And when you do make mistakes, you realize, too, that no matter how much money you make, how big you get, that certain things that only through the grace of God that you are forgiven. And that keeps me humble and on point of where I'm at in life. I never get too big for my britches. But just having that grace because it's not something that it's kind of like what's those – I don't want to compare it to sports at all, but I often think about the point that it's not something that you earn or deserve, right? It's kind of given to you, and that's a blessing. When we think about things like that, so sometimes I often say when things happen and I'm covered with grace, I'm like, my words, man. But every time, it's right there for me. I'm not worthy.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the foundation of what we do here, and I love what we do. I've said that numerous times. These two gentlemen are the strength of the fabric of what we do here. I love the fact that I can just put something out there. They don't shy away from it. They step right up to it, and they stand tall. And I've said this on many occasions. When we started doing this years ago, there's a few cats I walked up to. They love the idea. They love the premise. But it was time to basically turn the microphone on, they ran and hide. They couldn't just basically communicate and talk. And that's something that a lot of us find hard to do. But these two gentlemen right here, they make it sound easy. Yeah, for that, I'm very appreciative. Gentlemen, there's a lady out there, 91 years old, that designed something a while ago that we use often, don't even think twice about. I'm talking about Gladys West. She helped shape what we know as the global positioning system, the GPS. So we salute her at 91 for basically making our lives easier. I'm sure you two might be aware, recently, Renee Montgomery, former WNBA standout player, made history the other day. She's part of a three-team investor group that is scheduled to purchase the WNBA team Atlanta Dream. And I want to congratulate her on more than one level and congratulate a lot of them, the WNBA players, because years ago, when it wasn't vogue to basically stand up and show that you're tired and we're not taking it anymore when police were killing black men, a lot of the WNBA players stood up when black men were cowards. And to this day, some are still cowards. And the NBA and NFL were afraid to open their mouth and say anything. She was one of the many from that league. And think about this for a second. She went from being a player of the team to a part owner. So we salute her. We salute Gladys West. I'm going to give you two gentlemen, if you want to say something about Renee Montgomery before we move on. I'll come to you first, Mr. Charles.
Just having the ability to realize that you can make a difference. There was a lot of controversy going on with the previous owner, and being part of something where you're not doing it just for yourself, your teammates, but it's something you're doing as a major part of making a difference in the league of improving a situation when you know it's bad. It says a lot, and particularly for an athlete, because a lot of times we are prone to think athletes are not the smartest people in the world, but there are a lot of exceptions to that rule. So to see her move forward and be a part of a group that makes a major difference when she sees something that's incorrect is these volumes.
Mr. DeMaurice, Renee Montgomery, you know, we watched her play. Now we're going to watch her own. A professional women's basketball team. Your reaction, sir?
Congratulations to her and much respect, because we live in a day and age where you have players, and I'm speaking on the men's side, who will sit and complain. They don't own a thing, but they sit and complain like they do and want certain things they can't have because they don't own the team and they don't run anything. But, you know, you have two type of people, the people who complain and people who do something about it. And she stepped up and she did something about it. And I salute her for taking that stand and the knucklehead that had ownership that ran for the Senate shouldn't have had ownership of that team at all with her views and what she believes in. So I'm glad that the ladies and she in particular took it upon herself to say, you know what, I'm not going to complain about it. Or I'm through complaining about it. I'm going to do something about it. So, salute.
Gentlemen, God made so many things available to us and did an awesome job putting this world together as we know it. And we probably can agree on this. One of the best things God ever did was creating a woman. And in creating her, he created a mother for all of us to come from. And tonight we're going to spend a little time talking about mom in general. One that gives birth. You know, we come from her. We learn a lot from her. And throughout our lives, our love, if we had them around, changed in different ways for our mother. Mr. Charles, earlier this week, you wrote something that came across, man, that stopped me in my tracks. And I wanted you to, if you don't mind, take your time, bruh, and explain to us, you know, what you wrote, what you felt, and how you got there.
Yep, thank you, sir. It was a post I put on Facebook, and it was February 24th. And February 24th represents my mother's birthday. And significance for it, I've seen a lot of people do it for different reasons. My reasoning behind it is because it's something I felt compelled to do. I lost my mom when I was 4 years old. So I only really had like 4 years that really I had physically connected to my mother, and I really didn't know her. I would have memories, but I really didn't know her. So I spent a lot of time in my life trying to find out as much as I could about her. And I had a few little nuggets that people gave me, and I just kind of took it, or my dad would say something, but nothing that really was concrete. I had very limited pictures. I had one picture of my mom and myself together when she was holding me, and then some other pictures of her with other people. But I never really had a lot of pictures, to the point that I really couldn't even tell the true facial recognition of my mother, what her features really looked like. Not up close, anyway. So the last few years, or even the last year, really, I should say, I told you guys about me trying to really dive into writing this book I'm engaged in. And I started doing research and on my family. And in doing research, I found out a lot about my father. I found a lot about my family. And I found out a lot about my mother. It's almost as if God was speaking to me, because in doing this research, I found out some things. People even sent me pictures. I finally got a picture of what my mother really looks like. Cry like a baby. Because that's my mother. That's what I look like. What I look like. And I cried like a baby. And I was like, oh, my God. I've waited this long to finally know who I resemble. And that hit me real hard. So that was going to be a part of my book. But the whole point of this is about the birthday is, for years, I knew my mother was, I knew her, I knew she was born in February. I knew what year she was born. But I didn't know her real birthday, her actual birthday. I searched. And I found out recently what her birthday was, that it was February 24th. So I said, after these many years of I've been in this world, I've never had to say happy birthday, Mama, because I didn't know what the date was. So this was a first for me. And I introduced and celebrated and recognized my mom on Facebook for the first time publicly, because I finally knew what her birthday was. With all that being said, as I walked through this, I just really talked about the fact that I said, even though our time together was limited, I felt her presence. I feel her presence every day. And I know that she's watching over me. And like I said, in the last few years, I found out so much about her. And each time I found out more information, tears would come to my eyes, because each nugget that I found out about her drew me closer to her. And definitely nothing has been able to replace her in my life. But I knew the physical sacrifices she endured to have me. And the story goes there very quickly. My mother and father were married for 13 years before they had me. My mom wanted a baby so bad. And then eventually they were married a total of 17 years before she passed. But she couldn't, you know, for some reason or other people have a baby, she couldn't have a child. And she got pregnant, and then she wanted to have me. But the physical issues were, my mother had tuberculosis, which means she had one lung at the time. And the doctor was like, there's no way in hell I'm letting you have a child, because it could kill you. She begged my father, begged the doctor to let her try to have a baby. And through the grace of God, another word of grace, I was born that year of way back when in May 2nd, I was born. And for a woman to go through what she did with one lung, she could have died at any time, but she persevered and had me. And they say that she was so happy, and you can see it in the picture, she was so happy to have me as her child. And as I said, nothing has been able to replace her in my life. Like I said, I know that the physical sacrifices she endured meant so much. And it definitely showed that she had much love for me. And knowing what she sacrificed has eased my pain of not having her in my life, physically. So at that point, I wanted to introduce the world to my mother in a way that I knew her for the first time, or first was celebration for myself of her birthday to recognize her for being my mother to the world and not having any notions or any regrets or anything about what anybody thought. And I just said, rest easy, Mama. This is love your son, Charles. And I left it there. And that was so moving to me. It touched my heart. And it was a good day. But from now on, for the rest of my life, I could recognize my mother the way I really had hoped I could a long time ago.
Hey, man, thanks for sharing, bro. Seriously, thanks for sharing. You're right. You in the picture, yeah, you and her look very much alike, man. Very much alike. Mr. DeMaurice, I wanted to bring you in on this in a little different way because your mother and I were related. She was my aunt, Aunt Dolores. And I always remember your mother having this keen little smile. You know, she might try a little mean for a second, but it just didn't last long. She always kind of break off with a smile. And she had a smile that just lit up the room, man. Just lit the room up when she smiled. And sometimes your mother wouldn't say much. I remember she wasn't much of a talker. Now, if you get her angry, she's going to go. I know that for a fact. She got angry. If she got angry, she would go. But most of the times your mother kind of, to me, kind of surveyed, kind of laid back, and she picked her chances or picked her times where she really was going to say some things. But we were talking the other evening, and you spoke of the date of her passing and some things that you go through. So I wanted to give you the opportunity to step in and share those things that you feel and your thoughts of your mom.
Yeah, my mom, you kind of made me chuckle because I remember that smile and her looking at that mean mug she had. Boy, you knew when she got that mean mug, you knew she meant business. You take it out the way and do what you got to do. But my mom was born in the first of the year. People debate whether she was born on New Year's or the 2nd of January. And she passed away in 96 on February 26th, which was last Friday. And I noticed over the years that I know my own mood kind of changes during that period of time. I don't know what it is. I don't know. I kind of get into a little funk, and I think about her a lot during that particular time period. And I never really kind of talked to people about it, that particular time period between the first of the year and the 26th. It's almost like I'm just kind of just reflecting and trying to figure out if I'm doing what she would want me to do. And I will always kind of think, you know, when I get into bad times, like, you know, what would she want me to do right now? And most of the time when I think about it, I think she already told me what she wanted me to do and how she wanted me to be and what type of man she wanted me to be. And it's kind of tough when you see other people lose their moms or they don't have their moms either. It's almost like it's a club. I have a lot of friends who don't and family members who don't have their mom, and you know, I try to kind of lean on the parts where or the parts of my life where, you know, the happy time and all that other stuff. And I guess what I kind of think of when I think of my mom is that, you know, she died at 47, which is too young, and I guess the guilt I have is that she didn't get to enjoy a lot of the things that I've done in life and a lot of things that her children have done in her life. And I kind of get kind of angry because it's like, you know, well, why would a creator take someone away who sacrificed not only physically but mentally having children and not watching them, even though I truly believe that she knows what we're doing. She sees it, but being here physically so we can look at that smile and see her being pleased about a lot of different things. I think when I was, when I knew she was getting sick, I was trying to really kind of soak in all this, her essence and trying to, you know, stop her pain, but I couldn't. And trying to do so many things to show her that I'm trying to be the man that you want me to be. I remember taking my daughter, who was about 3 months old, just putting on the plane, me and her on the plane, we flying down, seeing my mother and seeing her in a hospital bed, because one of the things my mother always wanted was a grandchild for me. Now, it was, you know, my sisters had grandchildren, but that wasn't good enough to her. She wanted a grandchild for me, her oldest, the only and oldest boy. And I have a picture. It used to be on Facebook, but I still have the picture where I'm standing next to my mom, and she has her hand on my shoulder. And every now and then, bro, I kid you not, in tough times, things of that sort, I feel like a presence or a touch on that shoulder, brother, every now and then. And it's a reminder that, okay, can't sit down and kind of soak about it. And that's the way she was. Like, listen, you got to get up and do something about it. I know how you feel, all this other stuff. You got to get up and do something about it. Or when times where I just wanted to give up, and she was like, I know you want to give up. I know you want to go and do whatever this is and be mad at people and you know, and just unleash your wrath. But this is not your time. This is not what you're supposed to be doing. You know, suck it up and do what you need to do. And you're better than this. And so there's a song that I think about that I hear. Lenny Kravitz lost his son too, the recording artist. And every time I hear this song, it's called Thinking of You, and he's talking about his mother. And if you ever watch the video or hear the song, it really kind of describes how I feel. A lot of questions, and in the song, it's like, I hope I'm what you wanted me to be. And so, yeah, you'll never, and when I talked to her, I had some friends or people who lost their mother recently in COVID and all that stuff, and they were talking to me, and we were talking, and I'm like, well, you never really get over losing your mom. You never really, but it gets better. It gets better. You start to chuckle some days of some of the things that you had talked about or some of the things that you had seen. You talk to family members who remember and remember great things about your mom. And it gives you a little, you know, a little pick-me-up. Or you'll hear people say, you know what, your mother raised you well. And that's the tribute that you get. And that's the thing that you think about, that, man, she did it. You know, people were recognizing the work she did and the work your parents did with you, then that's all right. That's all right. She did what she was supposed to do. She didn't have a handbook to do it. There was no classes to take to raise a son. And my parents didn't have, they were very young when they had me. And so it was trial by error. And I think I came out okay. So I salute her, think about her every day. And, yeah, that's my mama. That's my mama. And the crazy thing, I'm going to say this and I'm going to get out of here. I have a niece, my sister's daughter, and I have a picture of her. And my sister says that when she's walking through the house, it scares her because she looks, acts, and has the mannerisms just like my mother, but have never met her. Never met her. That was her grandmother, but she never met her. And I remember taking a picture with her over my shoulder, the same shoulder my mom touches. I don't know how she knew it, but she just got over my shoulder and somebody snapped the picture. And she is the splitting image. And every time my dad sees her, my dad just shakes his head and smiles because she's the splitting image of my mom. And the mannerism, the walk, everything, it's just kind of scary. But you know she's here. She's here, and she's representing.
You too, just find a way. Thank you for sharing and opening up, because it can't be easy. Here again, you too make it feel and sound very easy, and I appreciate that. And it's not always for men to kind of really go in and pull out and share some emotions from something that's kind of been there for a while. So I'm happy that we get together at least once a week for 90 minutes, and that's what we do on When Black Men Talk. I'm just going to just say this, which is kind of interesting, because for me, my mother when she was living really kind of prepared us for, in a sense, when she's not going to be here. I can't tell you how many times she said to me, and I'm sure my brothers and sisters, when she's not here, she wants to feel sad. She didn't want us to feel like we missed her. Well, she wants to enjoy what she did when she was here and not to feel that grieving part and not to go on, you know, belating the fact that she's no longer here. And it's interesting because I can honestly say it must have worked. It must have worked because, you know, her passing, I didn't really spend a lot of time with the grieving. I was fortunate in a way where we knew maybe 6 to 8 months previous to my mother passing that she was going to pass. They gave her a short period of time, 8 months before she passed. And that, I guess, helped, too, to kind of set the emotional part and kind of help out when she did pass, because I look at it at that point, you know, even not that it didn't matter prior to it, but from that point forward, God gave us a chance to prepare for her not being here. So it gave me plenty of time to spend time with her, say goodbye, say my goodbye, say some things. And sometimes when I would say those things to her, I know she couldn't even understand what I was saying, but it gave me the opportunity to speak to her one-on-one. And it had to play with that and her saying what she said prior to passing. And when she said those things, she was healthy. I mean, we were younger, and she just made it clear that that's not what I want. And if someone ever went to a funeral or someone passed, she'd make it clear. I don't want you all doing X, Y, and Z when I'm not here. Gentlemen, we're going to touch on a topic, a subject that might be a little tough. It's might be a little tough, but it never stopped us in the past, so it won't stop us now either. I title it Ma, Raise Your Daughters. Now, with that being said, I want to, before we get started into this, I want to really kind of lay the foundation and said that there's been a lot of mothers to no choice of their own, had to raise a household, had to raise kids, even if the father was there. And many times the father wasn't there. She was left with the duty to carry and raise the kids. And when we work through this, we're not basically looking for blame or pointing blame. But I felt like we spent a lot of time on this show, especially early on and throughout this show, showing the damaging effect of the father not being around for the kids, the families, our communities, stuff of that nature. And I don't think fathers overall take full responsibility for the damaging part. But one thing I have noticed over the years, there's been some others that have lacked the responsibility. And that's kind of failed. I mean, they kind of. Some have failed that responsibility of raising their daughters. But we don't talk about it. We kind of shy away from it because it almost seems like we talk about mothers as kind of taboo. And we don't put all in one cup. But there's some out there just haven't done some things. And I think some mothers have tried to raise their kids to the best of their abilities. They may not just have the capacity to do better. But I think sometimes when we run into grown adults, we could be looking at something that mom just didn't raise. So we're going to spend some time here again. It's a tough question, and everything we say may not be well received, but that's not going to stop us from saying it if we feel it. So we move on. And the first question I'm going to come out with to Mr. Charles is that in the back of your mind, you may have thought this from time to time, but a mother's role that played into a daughter or a woman that you kind of made a mint in your life when you was older, can you see where the role that she played a vital part into the woman that you have chose to honor or not honor?
Yes. I can say that. I think that the part that is played sometimes is the relationship that the mother had with the father, so the child's father. And depending on how the mother goes about it and whether or not the mother was on good terms with the dad, she can have a major effect on how a child feels about her father. So in this particular situation, the father was not with the mother. He wasn't dead or anything like that, but they were no longer together, and I think he ended up moving away. But the girl had limited access to her father. And she ended up growing up to be a solid woman, but there was a part of her that still always yearned to be around her father. And I think it affected her when it came to relationships. And she had a big thing that if you had an argument with her, or you were in a situation, I had an argument with her, instead of arguing with her, I said, you know, I'm just going to walk around until I argue with you right now. I'm going to leave. And she would kind of go hysterical. She'd go get hysterical on me, go crazy, like, don't leave me. People are always leaving me. And I was like, wow. So I had to adjust that, because I said, look, I'm not leaving you. I'm just walking away from the situation right now, because I need to get away. I need to breathe. I need some air. I don't think we should be in the same room right now, because I'm not feeling this. Like, well, just don't leave me. She would, you know, that happened a couple times. I'm like, I never said I was leaving. I just need a break. And I think that was one of the things that was affected. She was affected by it because of the lack of presence of her father in her life every day, and not seeing him enough. So I think the relationship between her mother and the father, where her mother could have maybe done something else, made sure she saw her father more, or tried to ease that, close the gap, if you will, as to what she needed. Maybe, you know, through an uncle or somebody else, a male presence. But that's something that definitely affected her life. Maybe something I think the mother could have done to help her with.
Yeah, it's tough in a situation like that, because if the mom and the dad had an outing, or I mean had a rough time together and things didn't kind of work out, the woman, if the father tends to move away or step away, the woman is still left to raise the child, and a lot of times she's hurting. And how can she basically put the hurt aside, not show the hurt, and basically tend to the daughter and basically nurture and give the daughter just about everything that she needs to really blossom into a woman and be whole? And that becomes tough. While you was talking, I was thinking about some things I saw coming up with my mother and my father. And my mother had this, you know, bitterness towards my dad. And I remember numerous times that she would say things about men in the presence of my two sisters. And my mother was good for calling on some men a no good pants leg. Now, maybe some more. But that was a phrase that she would use quite often. But if you think about that for a second, if she's saying that to two young, impressionable minds constantly, and not really paying attention to the damage that can do, because she's saying that based on where she is, what she feels, from what she's dealt with, but they're listening to it without understanding where that's coming from. So they're kind of getting their scope, their vision of men through some of her lashing out and saying things. And I know my mother was not the only one to have done such. Just not. And, I mean, I've heard other women say things about men when I was younger, much worse than that. So you put all that into the pile, the ingredients. It becomes very tough. Same question to you, Mr. DeMaurice. When you hear about the role, or think of the role that, you know, the mothers that are playing daughters, how that may contribute to the vital part of the woman that you choose or not choose to be with. I choose to honor, I should say.
It is a very critical role to women, because that's their role model of what a woman should be. But let me mention this first. I don't know if you remember on Sundays when you were living with your mom, she would come over, she would leave and go over grandma's house, and I was staying with grandma. From about 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night, she would, you know, go over and maybe help grandma do, you know, settle in for bed or a bath, or, you know, just kind of taking care of grandma on a Sunday. And man, the venom coming out of that room, I'd be in the living room watching TV. And the venom coming out of that room about their men.
There it is.
Oh my God, man. It's like, it was scary to hear them talk about, because, you know, during the week you see these women and they're doing their daily business. And it could be another aunt in the room. It could be somebody else in the room with them. And what they said they were going to do and how they felt about them. It was like, oh, man, is this what women do when men aren't around? And it was like, I wasn't even in the next room. The venom, bro. The venom that, oh, my God. It was some of the scariest conversations. And I used to eavesdrop. The TV would be on, but I was eavesdropping going, oh, my God, I think they're going to kill these guys, these men. Granddaddy, Uncle Horace, whoever the man was, I would look at them when I would see them and just shake my head like, man, I'm going to lay my eyes on you for one more time. So, you know, if I saw that as a male, I know, you know, my female family members saw that. And I know that had to rub off on them. And so I saw my ex-wife and her mom, and I think I mentioned it on the show before. Her mom was just one of the sweetest, most kindest, most beautiful human being to ever walk this earth. I truly think she was an angel. And what I saw her do is kind of reject her mom's kind of advice and guidance, maybe because how her mom was with her dad. Her mom really kind of served her dad, and maybe she didn't want that, you know, kind of role when she, you know, had a mate. So, and I kind of felt that. And some of the things, the good things that I think that you do have those situations where moms are, and I have some friends who are beautiful role models for their daughters. Beautiful, beautiful role models for their daughters. And their daughters, you could see them. I know one of my friends, her daughter's about 4 or 5. And you could just see, you know, all the stuff that she's putting into her and how attentive she is to her. And her, she goes out of her way not to have bad examples that her daughter can kind of look at and hold on to that as this is what women do. But you see women who do that. You see women who get bad examples of moms doing different things, and you can see that as they grow. But I also saw how you have the good role models as moms, and the daughters reject it. The daughters really reject it. And I could see it with my daughter. She was very close to my ex-wife's mom, her grandmother. And she's to this day still takes it hard that grandma's not there because she was the nurturer. She was the one that was you know, just instilling all these great things in my daughter. And a lot of people say, you know, oh, you're a teacher and now your daughter's a teacher. It teaches preschool. Her grandmother was a teacher and nurturer. So I think she got a lot of it from her grandmother. And I'm watching my daughter in action when I go up to the school and read for her students, the nurturer she is, how attentive she is to the kids, even though she may complain about, oh, these kids and such and such and such. I saw her grandmother do the same thing, but it never took away from the kindness and that sweet heart that she had. And I was talking to Mr. Charles the other day about this with my daughter. When she was about 6, that's when me and her mom divorced. But she's always been that one who always looks to seek out for you. And every night, just about every night, she'll give me a text or we'll do FaceTime and we'll talk. Or she'll like, you know, good night, Daddy, I love you. And I'll, like, I'll text back, you know, good night, Ladybug, I love you more. And so, or send her a nice little video or a funny video, something to make her laugh, something to know I'm thinking about her. And so you kind of see that. It to me, it skipped the generation and went to my daughter, where she's the example, and she's doing exactly what her grandmother did, got into the teaching profession and worked with children. She felt she had a passion for that. And now you see it in my daughter. So it's a critical role, man. It's a critical role. And I don't think moms really think about the great and critical role that is. You're setting up another generation. I don't know if you brothers ever seen this documentary kind of video. It's called Diary of a Retired Black Man. Please watch that video. It might be on YouTube. Please watch that video, because there's a scene in there where the mother is all acted, most of it acted out, and then they get reactions from, you know, people on the street. There's a scene in there where the mother is just berating. There are a couple of them where the mother is just berating and talking about the males in front of boys, in front of the daughters also, and the daughters just acted out right away. They just pick up like, this is the way it is, this is the way I'm going to act, this is what I'm going to do. This is my role as a upcoming woman. And the brother who did the documentary, I think purposely pointed that out, because a lot of what moms do, or the women who are the elders, sets the stage for the next generation. And even though we get the brunt of the, you know, the hit on, well, fathers are the examples for boys and all that other stuff, it's equally with the moms and the women. And they need to really kind of look at that and be very, very attentive to that, because it didn't pass you up. You're just as equal in this as we are.
Yeah, very good point, man. Very good point. I like the point about the generation. I think in our generation, when we were younger, I think the adults thought more of laying the foundation for generation. I don't even know if that word is even thought of anymore, man. I don't think it's still, when it comes down to family, you're thinking about the generation, what's coming behind you, how you're setting the stage, you're setting the foundation for what's coming behind you. What I find interesting, too, is that, you know, we hear the word, I'm independent, I'm not, you know, I don't need a man to take care of me, blah, blah, blah. A lot of that goes back to seeing the mothers deal with hard times for men. And they fought, like your ex-wife did, Ms. DeMaurice, they fought not to do some or repeat some of the same things that they saw that their mother went through. But ironically, and I applaud them for that to an extent, I do. But just like you spoke of your ex-wife, there's some beautiful things that her mother was doing. So she looked at one segment of her mother and discounted everything else and didn't get some other things, important things from her. And I think that's what happened with a lot of women and their mothers. They looked at some of their situations. Some of it they just took in, swallowed it down whole, and became who they are. They kind of basically lived through their mother's shadow, per se. And then sometimes when they live through that shadow, they get to be a certain age, and that shadow is not working. It's not working for them. It's not getting them to where they want to be. They're not happy in life. But that's all they know. They don't know how to go back and reevaluate and think independently and go, you know, maybe I should change some things. So they kind of stay there, and they stay right in there. But, yeah, the mother's role is vital to a daughter. And I'm not saying this to knock off the father's part. But here again, I think it's when you're not consciously aware of things that you're doing in front of your daughter, and how you're basically affecting her. I remember one time my niece, she's grown now. She's in her late 30s and just married not too long ago. And my sister and her husband at the time, my niece was born, you know, they were separated when my niece was young. So as she aged, he got divorced. And my brother, ex-brother-in-law, used to come by and pick her up, take her different places and drop her off. And every time he would drop her off, she would go into, I mean, and here's a little girl. I want to paint the picture for you of my niece. My niece would be standing there, and she would basically interrogate my niece about what they did and be mad at what they did right in front of her. So the first time I noticed this, I didn't say anything. And the second or the third time I noticed, I sent my niece out the room. And I checked my sister hard, man, hard, real hard, because my niece would damn near would be crying, and I'm like, my sister was getting off on it, and it's like, okay, you chose to marry this man, you chose to get pregnant by him, So don't make him out to be some bad, evil gangster now when you decide to do all this. She's a child. And that's what happened with a lot of situations, because you're mad at him. You're not mad because you're mad because you two are not together. You don't understand the damage that you're doing to her. And it's so interesting. My mother was in the room. My mother said nothing. And usually my mother and my sister are like, hey, you can't, at that stage of life, you couldn't have one without having another. And my mother did not open her mouth. But I know one thing, that stopped, especially if I was around, that stopped. Because that you can't do. And even in that particular scenario, she was setting the stage for my niece later on. And I just wasn't going to have it. I'm going to come back to you, Mr. Charles, with a question, because this is something I noticed too. And I, you know, and I'm not going to put this solely on mom, but we're talking about mom. I don't think that a lot of people realistically know how to raise kids, bro. They know how to make a kid, but they don't know how to raise kids. And they don't, with that being said, they don't take the time to understand the structure, the damage, what could happen. But for that reason, they hide behind religion. They hide it behind religion, and they think if they just throw religion at everything and throw religion at the child's going to magically appear, or the young lady's going to magically appear and not make mistakes and live her life. And that tends to happen. And if it's not religion that they throw at the child or the daughter, they throw fear. They use fear to kind of manipulate and to raise, instead of basically taking time out to show her and have her to understand. Is that something that you may have experienced or something that you thought of yourself, Mr. Charles?
Definitely. I have, because of the fact that being in a position that I don't have children, and then, of course, when I'm incorporated by these parents to help with their children, I'm like, well, hell, you're the parents, right? But they ask me to come in and help sometimes, but the point that you're making is really clear. It's almost like sometimes through osmosis, like this child's going to be good. God's going to take care of them, make sure they're good. Or the other part of it is you stop them from doing anything. You keep them at home like you're going, like they're an animal. But you got to keep them where they under your watch and care all the time, 24/7. Without teaching them life lessons, so they don't have to sneak around. They're going to do some things, but you have to teach them life lessons about who they are and being confident and growing as a person. And I think that just because you have children doesn't mean you have to know how to raise them. I was asked the question before, well, how do you know so much about kids? I said, one, I was a kid. So I understand that. Plus, two, I know the right way that I think kids should behave. I know what a kid and what kids, most of the times when you think about it, it doesn't take a rocket scientist. You don't have to have a kid to know this. Most kids want to be loved. They want to be educated. They want to be taught, including discipline. And they want you to show them that you care. But you care from the standpoint of what happens, and you have their best interest at heart, and you're doing anything in the world for them. That's what kids want. They want unconditional love. You get that to a kid, it's hard for them to kind of go outside the box. There are some exceptions like that. But then all of those things wrapped up into the one is what children want. And I think some of the parents that don't know how to raise kids had a horrible experience growing up as children themselves. So they didn't have a true example to follow. And then, hell, here they are with a child. And most times all they can do is turn around and either scare the hell out of them, or say, I'm just going to turn it over to the Lord, like you have nothing to do with it. So, yeah.
And that's why, I mean, it's easy for me to say this. Don't get me wrong. I'm going to say this. If you're not ready to commit to what you need to do raising a child, don't have one. I'll say it again. If you're not ready to commit, to really commit, to develop and raise a child, don't have one. Because you don't have to. There's nothing to say that you have to. Coming to you, Mr. DeMaurice. you know, we assume because, you know, a woman has a child that she knows how to mother and be there and raise and do all this. That's the assumption. But we know that's not correct. And a lot of cases, because she doesn't know, Mr. Charles makes a very strong point based on they may experience in their childhood, whatever the case may be, they turn to hard religion. And I say hard meaning they really push the religion real hard at a child, a woman. We're talking about daughters in this case. And that combined with fear, they use that to raise the child without necessarily getting in there and doing the work that's necessary. Your reaction, sir?
Yeah, I think in some cases that happens, and you know, there's no handbook on doing this, and even though there are handbooks that are written, they probably don't relate to our particular situations. So people grab at whatever they feel they can or should grab at that particular time to do the job for us. It's the same thing where, you know, you have all these parents who, I was watching television the other night, they're rushing to get their kids back into school because they can't handle being a parent or doing homeschool, or the kid is driving them crazy, things of that sort. And I'm talking about parents that don't work. Talk about parents that don't work. Now your child's at home and you don't know what to do with them because you wanted them to be in school for 6 to 8 hours. So I think people fall on things that they think that is going to be the substitute for good parenting. And basically, we parent from our experience. A lot of the stuff that we went through, we parent from our experience. But I always said that, and I still feel this in my heart, when you have children and you take the time to be with them and spend time with them, they guide you to be a good parent. If you really take the time and listen to them and be around them, they are your guide. They are your textbook on being a good parent. But a lot of us don't pay attention to them because, you know, I think you alluded to it earlier, we're not ready. We're not ready for all that responsibility and commitment. And so I think what you said was key about if you're not ready, then don't do it. But, you know, people catch feelings and things of that sort, and they get in the moment, and then, you know, having a child is the afterthought. And then, boom, the child is there. But if you really pay attention to your kid, and I say this being a professional working with kids and things of that sort, I can sit there and talk to a kid for about an hour, and then, you know, I'm turn them over to the parent, and it's like, well, I'm telling them, you know, what we did, what we talked about, and the parent goes, man, they don't even talk to me about that. How did you get that there in the first meeting? I'm just sitting there listening to the kid. I'm asking questions. I'm interested in what they're interested in. I'm entering into their world. And through that, I get to learn who they are and what's really bothering them and things of that sort. But again, you know, folks like to lean on other things to do it for them instead of really, really getting in tune with the child. And it's sad. It's sad. Now, I've seen it so many times, especially with the religion, other things, other people, schools, and all that. And then you have kids who say, "Well, I don't even know my mom and my dad, or I don't even know my mom, or I can't. My mom wouldn't understand if I did this and told her this, that, the other." And that's sad because this kid comes from you. They come from you. You know, and you don't know them, and you don't, you know, take the time to try to understand them. And I talked to her mom. She wasn't perfect, but she knew me. She knew what I was thinking. I try to hide stuff from her and all that. She knew what I was thinking, what I was about, what was on my mind to do. And, you know, and she didn't get it from no book or anything like that. I was her first child. I was her first child. So she knew me before I knew myself. And a lot of these parents don't. They don't get to know their child. You're supposed to know your child. My daughter can, when my daughter texts me or says something to me, I already know the question before she asks the question because I know her. And I will say things to her, and she was like, "Well, you make me sick," because I already know what's going to come out of her mouth. I already know what she's thinking. I just laugh. Just like grandma used to laugh at us before. Well, she knew it before we even said it or how we was feeling or the situation we are. That's the way I think that not only moms but dads need to know their children. Before, grandma used to laugh at us so hard because it's almost like she had a crystal ball. She could see exactly what we were going through. She had already been there, and she's telling you exactly the way to handle it. And you don't want to handle it that way because that ain't really what you want. But she's telling you because she knows you. She knows you and she loves you. And so I think I know we're talking about moms tonight, but just get to know your child. Get to know them. Get to watch them. You already know them. It's already set mechanism. You will know them before they know themselves. And you can really stop them or guide them before they get into something that is not good for them.
You have to invest in your kids, bro. You really do. If you do that, you will know them. If you don't spend any time investing into your kids, how can you know them? It's a phrase, man, when I hear this sometimes, it kind of bothers me. But it applies to some parents out here. Because to me, how can you say you're living your best life and you got kids? You having kids and your best life just don't go together. I'm just going to tell you that. Because kids come with a sacrifice. Whether you want to believe it or not, they do, man. They come with, they don't basically, you know, pass your letter and say, you need to make a sacrifice for me. But in essence, you do. And, it's interesting. Sometimes I remember Chris Rock said this one time. He said you could be at the club during the middle of the week and you run into a woman and she has two kids and at home. And he's like, what you doing out on a Wednesday night? Because she's trying to live her best life, bro. And interesting enough, you know, my mother sacrificed sleep to be around her kids. For the majority of time when I was young, my mother worked from 11 to 7. Sunday through Thursday, so that when we were sleeping, she was working. So when she got off in the morning, she could prepare us to get us off to school. And you would think that she would basically, once we got off to school, she would try to go to sleep. At that point, my mother would cook, make sure the time we came when we have something fresh to eat. And she would basically maybe take a nap a few hours before she went to work. That's sacrifice. So when you're trying to live your best life and you're fronting on Facebook and you got kids and you're doing, that's, where's your sacrifice? Because kids come with it. That's just something that you should learn to sacrifice for your kids. And here again, if you're not ready to make that sacrifice, it doesn't have to be a set sacrifice. But one does need to happen if you're going to have kids. They require it. They need it. So if you're not willing to make it, why are you having kids? Gentlemen, I want to thank you for taking on something that, you know, could have been a little tough, but we plow through and we bring what we know to it. We continue on, take a little short break, because when Black Men Talk featuring myself, of course. Oh, you're going to say my name this time around. Mr. Charles, Mr. DeMarie, we'll be back in a little bit. Said, you know, I'm wondering, Mr. Charles, have we become a little too comfortable with excuses?
I think that some people have. I think because of society that we live in, something doesn't work. It's like, man, you know what? And that phrase used to crack me up. I started to not like it because it became humiliating, particularly in our culture. Man, I lost my job. My wife left me. Hey, I don't know what I'm going to do. But you know what? It's all good. What? Damn, it's all good. You know what I'm saying? You know, and I found out, you know, I got this and that, and I might, you know, be going to prison for the next 5 years, but it's all good. But the whole point of getting that back to that is saying that and accepting it, but coming up with more excuses as to why something didn't happen instead of trying. I think it's so much easier in through society to say, if you don't persevere through, it's okay. Because there's a reason why it didn't happen. The white man held you back. Your daddy left you. Your daddy left your mama. He left all y'all together. Your daddy was a womanizer. So you go to jail, you a womanizer. Your daddy was an alcoholic. You was an alcoholic. On and on and on. When sometimes I think we forget the fact of that, despite what society has said and told us, that when you become an adult, you make your own damn choices and you can direct your life. Is it hard? Yes. Will you maybe need some counseling? Whatever you need to do, handle it. But know that you, in the end, at some point, can make the decision how you want to live your life.
Mr. DeMaurice, come on in this one, sir. Have we been allowing ourselves to become too comfortable with excuses?
Yeah, man. In this society has really kind of fed into that. And I always remember this poem that I learned in college. It was part of a poem of excuses are tools of incompetence. They build monuments of nothingness, and those who choose to use them seldom amount to anything. And that stuck with me. That stuck with me because I heard that in college. And I'm like, I can't come up with the excuse on why I didn't do this. There are no excuses. There are no excuses. I got to finish this. I got to go through this. You know, I was on my own at that particular time. And, you know, we used to have those parties in the union. And, you know, I love going to those parties. I love hanging with my boys. But, you know, sometime during that Saturday, I had to hit the books, and it's definitely Sunday before classes on Monday. I had to hit the books, go to the library or something to make sure that I was prepared because there was no excuse. I couldn't have an excuse. I had a hangover, and I couldn't, you know, I couldn't see the pages on the book. There was no excuse because I did not want to come back and be a failure. And so when I heard that poem, it was like a light switch went off. Like, there is no excuse. You got everything in front of you. You have to make the decisions to do what you need to do. But I think a lot of people rely on them because it's an easy way out. And sometimes people let you off with those excuses. People let you off with those excuses. And they don't build character. They don't build, in the poem it says, monuments. They don't build on anything. And you keep coming up with excuse after excuse after excuse, then you wind up, you're sitting there one day with nothing because you made the excuse on why you couldn't do it. Now, are there circumstances that happen and reasons why things happen? Yeah, but still no excuses. You still have that ability to do what you need to do to get things done. It's all about getting it done. Hook or crook, get it done. And so we live in a I know in current society now where, you know, I see excuses all the time on social media, with some of my students, a lot of different areas. And I try to give them what I got with that particular poem. Like, if you keep coming up with all this stuff, you're not going to ever accomplish what you need to accomplish. And so I understand hardships and all this other stuff, but if there's a will, there's a way. So we can work this out. We can make it work, but stop the excuses. And usually when I'm around people who have a lot of excuses, I try to get away from them as fast as I can because I don't want that on me. I don't want it on me. So I'm going to give you a lot of chances to do things. But if you come up with excuses all the time, that's not a person I want to be around. Why you can't do it, why you can't get it done, all this other stuff, it doesn't work with me.
Yeah, I double down on that, man. I can't be around you in the conversation, period, if you just drop a bunch of excuses. it just shows to me you're weak, bro. You're weak. And you allow yourself to sell yourself short. And the answer to the question, yeah, we have become way too comfortable with excuses, man. People are even trying now. They just find an excuse. Some things that they just don't even try. And that's across the board and throughout life. They'd rather put up what they think is a good excuse than apply effort. That's a word we don't hear too often anymore either. Effort. Just effort, man. Simple effort. We become lazy where we don't even want to ever try. We don't want to exert any effort unless it's doing something that's pleasing to us. If it's pleasing, satisfactory, then you know we can go all out with that. But if not, we don't. And there comes our excuses. And we rely on them. We go back to them. And we say them enough to where we think they're good. We have bought into believe they're good. And what happens, as you two basically both, you know, really kind of said, your productivity in life drops down drastically. Now you got to have another excuse to try to explain why that is the case. When you just didn't want to put the effort forth to do what you needed to do. So I worked at a place years ago. I mean, it was this radio station, and we used to meet. And I might have said this before. And we used to meet once a week. We always had a meeting to get to go over certain things. And if there was something from last week that wasn't correct, we try to correct. And I love the mantra was no excuses. You cannot show up to the meeting, and if you didn't do something correctly, have an excuse. You must take responsibility and do better. And that was the thought set, the mindset we had working at this station. You couldn't come in with excuses. Things happen, yes, whatever the case may be, but if you were scheduled to do something or something was supposed to have been done, you owned it. You didn't talk about excuses. And with that mindset, you worked harder to try to accomplish things. You work harder when you was on the air to sound more effective, to sell the station more, to do what you're doing. It just pushed you a little bit more. But if you got in the back of your mind thinking, well, you know, if I could just say this and get, no, there goes your effort. There goes your try. So it's real interesting. But yes, we have become way too comfortable with using excuses and relying on excuses not to get things done. Mr. Charles, you have a question for us this week, sir.
Yes. My question is, I'm trying to figure this out. I was thinking about this. We talked before about being single, right? And I came up with this kind of analogy. Some women have said that we are afraid to commit. So my question is, what do you think about this analogy now that we're older and we're single as men? We're on a locomotive train, right? The train is on the track. It's been on the track for a while. Train runs pretty good with only one conductor. And then all of a sudden, society says, man, that train is a damn good train. It's a good solid on time. It does what it's supposed to do, taking care of the people and getting people safely to where they need to go. Then all of a sudden they go, but, you know, that conductor could use an assistant. Like, man, it's a damn shame that conductor don't have an assistant. But the train been running, to keep running. Then all of a sudden they say, you could use an assistant. And then it's like, well, okay, we're going to hire an assistant, and we're going to bring an assistant on. Great. But the assistant doesn't want to do the work, keep the damn train running. So the question is, if you can't find a quality assistant to keep the train rolling like it's been running, then it's going to keep running, right, regardless. It's going to be on time. Is it worthwhile just to appease other people in society of running the train the way it's supposed to without an assistant if you don't find the right assistant? Or one that even kind of works with the plan? That's my question. I know that's a lot. That's what I got. What do you think about that?
Oh, man, that's a great question, bro. That's one of the best questions ever been put out in this damn show. I'm going to tell you right now. That's a good question. That's a good question.
You know what's interesting is,
I'm telling you, man, don't worry about the time involved. That's a good question. And that's reality, bro. If you can't find a quality assistant, why are you bringing them on? Why are you bringing an assistant on if you can't find quality? And the train is going to run regardless without the assistant. So assistant is there to help you elevate you as you elevate the assistant. The assistant is going to help that you're going to basically be able to provide, and they should be able to help you in areas to elevate you. So if they can't do that, they're going to be faulty in that, then the assistant has no place, no value, no worth being on the train. It's clear. It's not that hard. It's just that simple and clear. So then what society may think or say, because society's not moving the train. The conductor's moving the train. So when the society decide they want to step into the train and run the train, then that's a different story. But long as the conductor is moving the train and he determines that the assistant is not worthy to come aboard and assist and be of value, that's the word, be of value to the operation, then the assistant has no place upon the train. Your response, Mr. Timmerich?
Yeah, I've been in times of conducting that train, and it's like everything's rolling real well. And then, oh, yeah, I want to get in the train. You think you can make this train run a little bit more efficient on that? You in a different city. You fall asleep. The train going in the other direction. All kinds of stuff. I think that was a great analogy. Being the conductor on that train, I thought you were going the Snowpiercer route, the show Snowpiercer route with that train, I think we're all looking for, if we're running the train really well, we're looking for somebody to enhance that train, run smoother, faster, to greater destinations, things of that sort, and we welcome that. It's not that we are afraid to commitment or afraid to have an assistant on that train, but if you're not bringing anything to that train that's going to make it better and to get to the destination that we're trying to get to and not causing distractions, you get on the train, you're like, I'll take it over for a little while, and then you fall asleep and you wake up, and you're late for the destination, you ain't where you're supposed to be and all that other stuff. That's what we don't want. It's not the commitment. We don't want the drama, or you stopping the train because of some drama that you want to kick up. So, I think that's a great analogy, and, I think if single ladies are listening to this and kind of wondering, why men won't commit, it's because, we need a helpmate. And that's what the Bible says, a helpmate to do what we do. And I don't think women realize that if a true man, not some of the bozos that are out there that are just playing like they're men, but a true man, if you're giving to that man's going to give to you, and y'all both rolling. Drama free, y'all know your roles, and you're just rolling. It's where other people are getting involved in it, saying, I don't like the way that train is rolling, and you should do this and you should do that. That's going to delay the train. That's going to delay the process. So if two people can get together and say, hey, this is what we can do, this is, the destination, everybody's clear on what the destination is and what it's going to take to get to that destination in that journey, then roll with it. You ain't going to have a problem with a man committing. You're not. It's not. Because he knows that no matter what, this person got my back, and we're rolling in the right direction, and we're going to get to where we need to go. But if you're not down for that, and you're there for all the drama, you're going to have a problem committing. He's going to have a big problem committing.
I think that is one of the biggest fallacies out there, man. And I'm not sure if it came from the Oprah Winfrey show, Cosmopolitan, or whatever, that men are afraid to commit. And it's kind of based on when they say that, it's like we're afraid to commit because we want more than one, or the case may be. No, we don't want to commit to you. So now we're afraid to commit. We may not just want to commit to you. So realistically, maybe there's things about you that's not worthy of a commitment. And that may sound harsh, but it may be correct. And it's what you might be presenting, what you might be offering as an assistant, again, It's not worthy of a commitment. And there's some men commit foolishly. They commit based on the way you look, what you may offer sexually, but that's not long-standing. That's not a solid foundation. And that's when you run into the bozo because, yeah, he was willing to commit you real fast because he had his agenda, what he wanted from you. So if you want a real true commitment, start with yourself first. Reevaluate who you are, what type of assistant you can be. And because men are easy. Men are real easy. But if you notice that and you handle that part of it, your commitment will be easy to obtain. So when I hear that men don't commit, no. I'm going to say this, Mr. Charles, I'll come back to you. I saw a lady on TV one time say she went to all these dating sites and she couldn't find anyone. And she spent money. They were trying to match her with someone. And finally they told her, it's not the dating sites people want, it's you. It's you. I mean, and it's, she couldn't understand it. No, it is you. And sometimes you need to look in the mirror. It's not that they won't commit. It's what you're bringing for them that you offer that they want to commit to. Take an honest look at yourself. Would you commit to you? Your response, Mr. Charles.
Yeah, it's crazy. Because when I thought about this earlier in the day, it might think this is wild, but I felt it. It was like, this is just, it just makes a lot of sense. But you're absolutely right. You guys are absolutely right. It's kind of like, you see this thing working. People are living their lives. They're doing well. I had a friend talking about this the other day. Like, would you get married again? Would you get married, or should people be married as you get older? Is marriage a consistent option now? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know now. I'd rather have a companion, and that way you ain't got to go through the legal drama or whatever, and you just commit to one another, and that's what y'all do. Because sometimes when you talk about marriage or things, people get weird like that. You guys have been married. I have not. They get weird. It's like when you sign that piece of paper, people start acting different. You ain't getting no sex no more. You're not doing this. People don't want to clean up. They'll have, like, they ain't got to do what they need to do anymore because of that piece of paper. And I'm like, psh, give me a couple of assistants. Anyway, I said a couple. Anyway, just give me an assistant. I was just saying, man, at the end of the day, we all want to be happy. So why can't we just all get along and work together and quit making this so damn crazy and serious? I think you guys, Dee Marie, hit it on the head. We have one plan, one goal, and let's work towards that goal, and let's make it happen, and let's have a fruitful life for the rest of our days. But it's hard to find. Everybody got a hang up. As you said, somebody told me this. You wanna do? I mean, really? How the hell you know? That's why you home by yourself getting divorced 3 times. Anyway, that's for another story. That's for another day. Wow.
Oh, I'll say this. I come to you with a question to your question, Mr. DeMaurice. I don't think the objectivity for a lot of folks, Mr. Charles, is to be happy, bro. I don't think they really know what makes them happy, and I think there lies the problem. They want something that they believe is going to make them happy, but they don't know how to be happy. And they're not happy because you got to be happy first before you commit anything else. But they think and getting that commitment is going to make them happy. And they're not happy now. So once they even get that, they're not going to be happy. That's not their object. It's just not their object. Mr. DeMaurice, your question, sir.
I was thinking about this after our show this week, and talking about the coach, that a gymnastic coach that just killed himself, and the doctor that's in jail. And I was listening to I was out early this morning, running some errands. It's running errands all weekend, but out this morning listening to a news show, and what I found out was that one of the gymnasts who was victimized by these two, kind of explained the situation that it was a good cop, bad cop situation with those two, that they were in partnership kind of. So the gymnastic coach was the bad cop who would berate the young ladies who would, you know, they would, you know, were in such bad shape when they were going physically and mentally that they would be throwing up and getting sick before practice because they didn't know what was going to happen and what tirade and all this other stuff. And then they were turning them over to the physician who was playing the good cop, you know, consoling them, giving them hugs and doing whatever he was doing to them behind closed doors. And so it made me kind of think, man, you know, I know some of us have friends and partners that we roll with. Are you your brother's keeper? Are you the one that is the one that's a responsible one that says, you know what, bro, you're doing something that's totally unethical or inappropriate, and I'm going to step to you man to man and really kind of talk to you about it and talk you down from it or talk you out of it instead of participating in his madness?
I'll say yes, but I'm going to say this, man. I only have three kids, bro. Only have three. As a parent, there's no way you berate my kid. It's not happening, bro. And some of these parents of these young girls, and I'm not taking these two guys off the frying pan, what the fuck were they doing? You do not turn your daughter loose to anyone privately that have the opportunity to berate your kids. But sometimes they look at these kids, these parents are pimping these kids out. Same daughters that was with R. Kelly. They're pimping these kids out to try to get them to a certain point. There are nuts in this world, fanatics, dumbasses, and you're leaving your kids with them and expecting good to come out in the long run. There's no way my child will come back from a situation and is acting differently. And the least thing would happen is my foot up is going deep up in your ass. So I'm going to leave it at that and give it to Mr. Charles.
Yeah, it's crazy because oftentimes people just go along with something, right? Cause they don't want to shake things up. They don't want to be honest with somebody. But I never understood it. I mean, I know, for instance, when we used to play ball at different Y, and then you would see, like, a guy we playing with might bring his granddaughter up there, and you see another guy go, man, she done grew up. Damn. Like, she's 14. I was like, man, what the hell? Look, like, what was wrong with you? Oh, man, she done got sick. What? I don't know, man. I've always had an issue with anybody that, how you can look at a little girl that you know is a little girl, even if she's trying to act older, you can just look at her. And definitely if you talk to her, you know she's a child. I don't understand how you can do that. And with these gymnasts, as you mentioned, that situation is crazy because basketball player coaches do the same thing. Good cop, bad cop. It's a reason why, and I'm going to throw this name out there, not saying he's on that same level, but Bobby Knight was always angry. Somebody had to bring them kids back to reality and kind of be like, well, you know, our coach is a good cop, bad cop. And the psychological drama that they use on these children is crazy. Because the kids are not even understanding what's going on. All they're doing is just trying to process, what can I do better? Why is coach always mad at me? And then, too, they don't even realize, like, on the flip side with these gymnast coaches, that they're being abused or doctored or whatever, they're being abused, when they're always looking for somebody to comfort them instead of somebody taking advantage of them. And they're so damn vulnerable. And then the parents at home don't understand, well, you know what, you can't lose that scholarship, right? Is that what we hear? You know, you about to go trying to go pro, you ain't trying to go make the Olympic team. And you know you didn't charge the Olympic team. Why are you causing problems? Damn if you do. And you stuck because now the child's like, he's abused. The child's like, she's saying, this person is abusing me. What am I alternative? That's the sad thing.
Yeah, that's why I put more, I mean, not to take them off, man, but as parents, you have to protect your kids better than that. There was a father, I said this in a sports show a few months ago. His son was coming home wanting to kill himself based on what the basketball coach was doing. And the father won't get ESPN and complain about it. Are you serious? What type of dad are you? Realistically, what type of father are you? Your response is serious.
Yeah, it really hurt me when this lady, she's older now, she's professional, and the reporter was asking her, she okay now? She said, no, I'm not okay. He said, because there were a lot of adults other than these two that were involved in this, and they let it go. They knew what was going on, let it go because of the money and how, you know, the whole gymnastic team and that whole system needs to be revamped. And this is a grown lady who, you know, this years ago it happened, and she's still not okay. And we as adults have to be better when we have young minds and young children, especially children involved. We got to be better, and we got to hold each other accountable. I mean, I think this was very sick, and it really hurt. You know, me being up 7:30 in the morning, going out there running errands, and hearing this—that's not what I wanted to start my day with. But we got to hold each other accountable. And I always kind of think, am I my brother's keeper? And I'm fortunate to have men in my life and have been a man to other brothers who will put my hand on their shoulder and like, yo, bro, nah, that's not right. That's not cool. And so I think, you know, we need to hold ourselves accountable and also other brothers accountable when they're in the wrong and say, hey, you know, this is wrong. And really hold people accountable because we're wrecking some people's lives. And it hurt me to hear that woman talk about that this morning, but I could not turn away from that station. I wanted to hear the whole story.
Quick, gentlemen, we got 3 minutes before we're going to get up out of here, pack up and shut things down. A quick hit for you, Mr. Charles.
Yeah, my quick hit is, I've been watching 60 Minutes this evening. I've heard about a lot of information on this. But apparently they come up with a new version of the vaccine that's only one, take one dosage. And it's not as strong as the other ones with the two dosages, but you should just take it just because. Just get vaccinated any way you can and just get it done. I'm like, what do you guys think about them? This sounds like a damn generic version of this vaccine that you're trying to push to the people when, hell, you might get sicker. What do you got to think about that?
I'm going to make this real fast, man. Make this real fast. Money, bro. Money. Someone said this a while ago. Cancer's been around for a long period of time. They still can't cure that. But in a matter of months, they came up with a vaccine that you could take for a virus that they don't even know, they don't know much about. Your response, Mr. Durance?
Yeah, I really don't know. All I've been doing, man, is just kind of just sitting in the cut, just watching everything, man. Just watching, seeing how it's going to kind of affect people. But it seems like it's at an accelerated pace. Science is something else, and these folks are in pharmaceutical companies and drug companies are doing. Seems like they're doing their due diligence, but you know, it could be money, it could be a whole lot of things. But it's just kind of just interesting, just watching, just sitting back in the cut, just watching and seeing, and trying to be careful before I make that venture into getting a vaccine or things of that sort.
Not doing it, man. Not doing it. We got like a minute. I can tell you now, I'm not doing it. 30 seconds, Mr. Charles. What you got, sir?
Nah, I mean, I'm looking at it because I'm like, if I decide to do it, hell, I want what the first responders got. You know they need them. So, hell, I want a bunch of shots. Otherwise, I don't want it. You can keep that generic stuff. This ain't Kroger. Anyway.
So, well,
I'm going to say this, man.
Viagra, so.
Yeah, that's true. I'm going to say this, Jeff, before we get out of here. In Connecticut, they've chosen now not to give it to the first responders. Makes you think about it a little bit, huh? They chose not to give it to them. Very interesting. Gentlemen, we get together soon. Always appreciate what you two do and what you bring. It's One Black Man Talk. Mr. Dean Reese, Mr. Charles Mark Elliott.